joining us for our fourth quarter conference call. Joining us on the call today is Craig Bolanos, founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. Craig, the call is yours.
Well, Lisa, thank you so very much. And to all of the families that we represent across the country, thank you for dialing in on this most glorious Friday. And I begin by reminding everybody it is a fantastic Friday because unless my eyes deceive me, we just created 266,000 jobs in the past month, far better than anyone would have expected. The unemployment rate ticks down to 3.5%, matching the lowest unemployment rate since 1969, and best of all, for the second consecutive year in a row, we now have wages growing at 3% year over year, 2 years in a row. America's getting pay increases. But that being said, this continues to be one of the most unloved bull markets of any point in time, and we thought it was incredibly appropriate going into the end of the year to make sure everybody has their sights focused on the strategies and the outlook for 2020. I think the topic or the soup du jour would be equities after 10 years. How durable is the bull market? And who better to discuss that? Then joining us on the phone is Brian Forrester from Lord Abbott. And I mentioned that Brian is very apt to discuss this, not just because he drives investment and market insight for Lord Abbott's growth and international capabilities, not just because he spearheads equity product development and monitors the industry landscape to make sure all of the offerings continue to remain competitive, but it's because after that fantastic initial couple years of the bull market's expansion, even coming off the heels of 2013, a good year in the markets, Brian had penned an article discussing that long-lived bull markets tend to bring out what I call the doubters. And Brian, back then, you actually called for continued expansion, and not a lot of people did, and gosh darn it, you're right. So I think everybody is hanging on the edge of their seats this morning, and we want to know seriously what you and your firm's outlook is moving into 2020, coming on the heels of this tremendous economic expansion and a stock market that's produced really great numbers in 2019. So with that, Brian, I turn the call over to you.
Well, thank you, Craig, and good morning, everyone. And, you know, you kicked it off right where I was going to, and that is, you know, it's great news to see this labor market. But what's even better, I think, from a, you know, as you think about the next year, the next couple of years, is that the U.S. consumer is very healthy. And I think that's probably the biggest takeaway as you think about the equity markets and the duration of this expansion. And, you know, you're right. You know, as you think back to 2013, when we wrote that article, and it was, we actually wrote a piece, it was called Twilight of the Dystopians, which was, you know, kind of a reference to all of the doom and gloom you heard, you know, for very good reason in 2008 and early 2009 that there was this very dystopian or kind of a very hostile view towards future growth in the U.S., a view that we were going to go through a long period of decline. And what followed was in a very aggressive policy initiatives by the Fed, by the federal government, to really stave off the next Great Depression. And in 2013, we really felt that even though we were not seeing a whole lot of organic growth, that the collective U.S. government had actually done something really great in preventing the downward spiral of deflation. They had prevented really an implosion of economic growth or really pushing the economy into it, what could have been a depression, and kind of kept the economy going through quantitative easing, through really aggressive purchases in the treasury market. And the period from 2009 to 2015, we would call that the QE era. where the equity markets basically went up, you know, kind of in lockstep with one another. If you threw a dart at a bulletin board of stocks, you pretty much picked a name that went up, you know, perhaps 100%. And it wasn't really driven by a whole lot of economic growth, but most importantly, we didn't fall into that abyss. What we've seen since then has really been an acceleration in real organic growth in the U.S., and that was something we really didn't see during the first half of this, you know, 10-year expansion. So when I hear people talking about, you know, do you think we're getting to the end of the cycle? It's been 10 years. I kind of pause for a second and say, well, it really hasn't been 10 years. We've only really been seeing this true organic growth in corporate profits and consumer spending really for only about the past 4 years, when we kind of had the courage to unwind the quantitative easing program. And you even saw the Fed raising rates, which was, in my mind, a very encouraging signal as well. Now, in thinking about the next couple of years, a few things come to mind, and the first is don't fight the Fed. Now, you know, I mentioned those rate hikes. I think what was surprising to most market observers coming into 2019 is that we felt that there was a likelihood that the Fed would keep raising rates to try to normalize, not to choke off the expansion, but really to try and get back to a point of normalcy in terms of absolute level of rates. And of course, over the past few months, we've seen three rate cuts, primarily to stave off the risk of a trade war. And as we all know, the Fed's dual mandate is to achieve maximum employment as well as moderate inflation. And they define that today as about 2% inflation. And we're actually, you know, if you look at the data today, we're almost exactly at that dual mandate. So what Jerome Powell and the Fed have done in recent months is look at sort of an unpublished third mandate, and that is to make sure we don't fall into any recessionary pressures from this trade war, from the risks outside the U.S. And certainly when you look outside the U.S., in developed Europe and developed Asia, things are not quite as rosy as they are here. And then you can go all the way back to 2009 and how those countries responded much less aggressively to the global financial crisis. But nevertheless, you certainly do have risks around the world when it comes to the trade war, when it comes to what happens with Brexit. You know, there still is an ongoing refugee crisis around Europe that they're dealing with, the rise of different, you know, nationalism, the very polarized political environment around the world. So we're not all Pollyannic about the equity markets and global growth, but we do think that a lot of the naysayers, a lot of that dystopian view still exists in the market today that has really kept valuations compressed. And I say compressed because I think when you watch CNBC or Bloomberg on a regular basis, there is sort of, you may not have the doomsday individuals like Nouriel Roubini and Mark Faber and Peter Schiff on TV every day, but there still is this doubt, right? There is this view that we're only a year or so away from the next horrific recession, the next horrific financial crisis. And there really are none of the signals or signs or in market environments that you had in 2007 or 1999, one being a financial crisis, the other being a stock market bubble, that lead us to believe that is anywhere near on the horizon. You know, this may look like, we've heard this bull market and expansion described as being old, and it is, by certain metrics, one of the oldest ever, but we view it as being long chronologically, but really much more middle-aged biologically, meaning that we have not seen an enormous amount of GDP growth over the past 10 years, only about 22%, the typical expansion, you usually see 35 to 40% cumulative GDP growth. So in that, by that metric, we're only about 55 to 60% through a typical GDP expansion. It's really more the age of it that financial press focuses on, that it's been 10 years. And I think the thing we're most excited about and that gives us the most confidence is that we are living in this age of technological revolution, that you are seeing change and innovation at a faster pace than at any point in human history. And I think this really gets lost in some of the more traditional metrics when you think about, you know, how far the equity market has gone, or are we at a peak employment level today? Could it only get worse from here? When you think about really what's going on within industries, when you think about cloud computing revolutionizing the way we process and store data at the corporate level, it is dramatic. I think most CEOs around the country, that is one of their top two or three priorities, is to overhaul their IT infrastructure and replace the servers in their basement with cloud platforms. And that has been an unbelievable boom to businesses, both from an efficiency standpoint and a cost-saving standpoint. When you think about biotechnology and companies that are getting drugs to FDA approval, real life-changing drugs in areas like cystic fibrosis, cancer, rare diseases, drugs that are going to be life-changing, they are getting to approval in 6 years instead of 20 years thanks to the genomics revolution. The decoding of the human genome back in 2003 is now playing a major role in drug discovery that is going to help people live healthier, better lives, and longer lives. And then when you think about areas like e-commerce, it certainly feels like it's been with us now for many decades, but really only 10% of the retail market today is e-commerce. There's still 90% that is not. Certainly when you think about having just probably spent a good amount of money on Cyber Monday, it might feel like most of what we spend is online, but when you look at the aggregate, it really is nowhere near where it could be. So we still feel like that is a big transformative area of the economy that is generating wealth, creating new efficiencies, and also making the consumer, having them be able to save more money because they're spending less. So we feel like some of those areas, think about artificial intelligence, industrial robotics, it leads me to believe that there are areas of innovation that investors should be focusing on, and that is certainly one area that we're excited about at our firm, is investing in the concept of innovation and also avoiding areas that are threatened by innovation. And there are certainly many areas, you know, if you think about in telecom or utilities or consumer staples that are very threatened by that. So we believe actually, you know, looking at your portfolios today, if you think about equities, we think it's great to stay diversified, owning a mix of innovation, but also dividend growers, dividend earners, companies that have been able to adapt to innovation. That's a great balance of owning those two types of equity portfolios. We think it's also very important as you think about asset allocation heading into what could be a little bit more volatile year because of the U.S. elections, to make sure you stay diversified, but also to avoid the impulse to try to time the next downturn or the next bear market. I think if the prior five elections have told us anything, it's that it can be a little choppier, but certainly when you get past the election, regardless of who wins, that you often see a protracted rally in the equity markets just for the fact that that election is over. And I'm sure this is going to be a hostile election coming up in November. But the relief rally that typically follows has been pretty persistent over the past five or six presidential election cycles. I think a couple of the themes and the takeaways that we have. Number one, don't fight the Fed. We do believe equities have a longer, much longer way to go than what you're probably hearing from the financial press. Valuations remain compressed to where we think they really should be, especially when the 10-year is below 2%. Valuations actually look fairly compelling at the aggregate level. Number two, stay diversified, and I mentioned those two areas that we feel are most compelling, these areas of innovation, but also areas of durability, namely in sort of those blue chip dividend growth stocks. And then number three, avoid the impulse to really try to time the market You know, for every 10 to 20% pullback we've had over the past decade, you have seen a dramatic reversal following by a magnitude of 2 to 3x. So trying to time when to be getting out of the equity market, or trying to time when to go from growth to value, it has really been a fool's errand to try to time that. And usually you end up not only the missed opportunity cost, but also losing money, losing capital by trying to make that very important timing decision. So we do feel like a mix between, say, credit-driven fixed income and then those two areas of equities, those are the areas we find most compelling today. So I'll pause there. I know that was a very high-level overview, and I'm certainly happy to take questions and go into more detail.
Well, Brian, thank you for those comments. And through those comments, you actually answered some of the questions that we see with the most frequency, such as, you know, it's said that bull markets tend to die of excess. Do you see excess today? And you discussed very specifically that some of the excesses that were here in the last two rounds of what I deem to be financial crises just aren't present today. You know, the other comment we continue to seek from people, or receive from people rather, is the simple saying of just look how old the market is. And it was interesting because you said chronologically old, but did I hear you correct in saying biologically middle-aged? Was that how you phrased it?
That is.
No, it's a very interesting way of discussing. So
yeah,
that go ahead.
There are just none of those telltale signals of an oncoming recession that you would normally see. You would not see areas like semiconductors rallying. You would not see employment at 3.5%. You would not see consumer spending continuing to rise. And the one piece of data that I've failed to mention is you talked about wage increases. The one thing about this technology revolution, and this actually happened prior in the Industrial Revolution of the second one from the 1870s to 1920s, is technological revolutions tend to be deflationary by nature. If you think about the iPhone today, and I'm not the first person to make this observation, but it's a very apt illustration that the iPhone that many of us have in our pockets, which costs anywhere between $750 and $1,000, would have cost about $40,000 20 years ago for all of that component technology. So there is a very deflationary aspect to technological change, and we feel like that is very present today. And during that period from 1870 to 1920, you actually saw deflation, even though you were seeing these incredible gains in technological progress, from the fossil fuel revolution to electrification of businesses to mass production. They led to wage inflation, but it did not pass through into overall market inflation or CPI inflation. And that is something we think is similar today. So we are not very concerned that the Fed has cut rates to try and stave off that non-U.S. threat, because we don't feel that there is a real inflationary surge coming, even though you have this great economic data. So it actually is a very favorable backdrop. And that's why I said middle-aged biologically, because usually this is the type of environment you see halfway through a cycle, not at the very end of the cycle.
No, those are great talking points. And on a lighter note, I'm going to remind my two high school boys, one in college, one in high school, that they should be more careful with their $40,000 handheld devices.
Definitely.
So one of the things I was thinking about, and this is maybe an observation, is, despite the fact that stocks are up, quite a bit over the last year, am I correct in saying that we continue to see some net outflows in stock mutual funds and ETFs? Specifically, I remember a trade piece coming across my desk in September citing that there was almost $1.1 trillion that had left the stock market over the last 12 months. Now, as a firm, Wealth Management Group chose to ride out that volatility, and we've clearly been rewarded. But what does this really mean? Are there that many other investors that have missed out and are sitting in cash on the sidelines?
It has. It's been, as you, I think, alluded to earlier, this has been the most unloved and distrusted bull market probably ever. And, you know, we've done some work on this as well. And if you look over the past 10 years, just at the mutual fund and pension fund world, $3 trillion net has come out of equity mutual funds and equity pension funds. So that is not the type of thing you would see if we were in a stock market bubble right now. And I sort of smile when I hear people say, isn't this starting to look like 1999 all over again? Certainly not. You know, in 1999, the S&P 500 hit a PE of 35. But then when you looked at the NASDAQ 100 or the, say, the triple Q, that had a PE north of 100. And then small cap growth stocks had a PE north of 300. When you look at today and you say, well, the market is trading at 17 times next year's earnings, 19 times last year's earnings. But also when you look at small cap stocks trading at 17, those numbers are nowhere near what you saw back during that bubble. And if anything, they probably deserve higher valuations because you're seeing robust revenue growth and earnings growth, especially in areas like technology and healthcare, but also in areas that are more durable in blue chip stocks. So from a valuation standpoint, this is nothing like what you saw during that sort of irrational exuberance period of the late 1990s.
And I'm very happy you commented on that because, again, I had three written down: the age of the market, the valuation of the market, but something else that's extremely common, and I understand why we hear it, because the noise and rhetoric has never been as loud as it's ever been. But would you feel comfortable talking about everyone's fears over the, I'm just going to deem it to be, dysfunction of global politics and the related economic uncertainty that is spurred from such?
Sure. I mean, I'm still trying to remember when we had functional global politics and economic certainty, but that is certainly something that we always like to view, that whatever's happening today is worse or more intense or more problematic than in prior eras. But if we talk specifically, say, about the U.S. elections, we expect very contentious rhetoric, regardless of who the Democratic candidate is. But I think that has been sort of become normal. I think that many investors, the markets themselves, have been conditioned around this very polarized world that we live in. And it really goes back to the financial crisis. I mean, I think that we have been increasingly polarized regardless of who's held the Oval Office. And there really has been a hollowing out of the center. Certainly overseas, it's very similar as well. When you look at Great Britain, when you look at Germany, you look at France, these are all countries grappling with a polarization issue. I'm not saying that it can't certainly cause short-term dislocations. I mean, certainly Brexit was a big shock. I don't think many people saw that outcome. But again, those are things that we feel become issues when nothing else is going on. And maybe that sounds a little too simplistic, but when you go through, say, in September, we saw a big rotation within the equity market where momentum-oriented stocks had a massive sell-off and then cyclical stocks had a massive rally because there was a view that the trade war might end sooner than expected. And then that sort of has sort of waned over the past couple of months. You don't see those types of rotations, though, during earnings season. And that really is when the rubber hits the road. And the reason I bring that up is I feel, and I think we at Lord Abbott feel, that it really is earnings, GDP growth, low inflation, and then I'll say earnings one more time, that really are what drive the equity market. It's really not a lot of this noise around politics. Now, you do have to certainly look at policies and say, how will they impact various parts of the equity market? We certainly look right now at some of the more aggressive proposals from some of the Democrat candidates around health care, and we don't say, do we agree with them or disagree with them? We say, how is this going to impact biotech stocks? How is it going to impact the perception around drug pricing? We look at what Europe is doing around privacy. How is that going to impact Facebook or Twitter or antitrust today? How is that going to impact Google or even Amazon and Apple? So we think much more non-politically around how they affect the equity market and how they affect certain different sectors. And through that lens, we do not see a lot of these very, I don't know if the word's toxic or very polarizing issues really hampering the economic cycle or hampering equity markets. We don't feel like that would be the trigger to say, okay, the bull market is over because so-and-so won an election or so-and-so, you know, is being extremely aggressive in their rhetoric. Now, certainly we are willing to admit that things could change and you could have some very unexpected reality pop up and, you know, something like Brexit. But from where we stand now, we don't look at the 2020 elections as sort of like if this person wins, everything's good, and if this person wins, everything would go down 50%. We don't see that driving the equity markets. We are much more confident around what the consumer is doing today, how corporations are taking advantage of innovation, and you know, really how the U.S. has almost kind of separated itself from a lot of the stresses around the world, thanks to almost a decade of what turned out to be much better policy reactions to the financial crisis.
No, I think those comments are all well-received, spot-on. I think they're in congruence with a majority of the talking points we've been using at Wealth Management Group for the families that we're stewards of. And then just, you know, one other thing, though. As we talk about earnings, which has been a theme throughout our discussion this morning, is, as you indicated, that stocks are ultimately moving on earnings. And as an investor, how do you balance the idea that, you know, the economy is still growing, albeit at a slower pace, but, you know, year-over-year earnings might actually see a decline? How do you rationalize that we can still get, you know, multiple expansion, price appreciation, et cetera, in that environment?
Sure. So we do not necessarily look at the equity market the way we did, say, in 2013, 2014, when you had QE kind of rising all boats equally. We do feel this has become much more of a stock picker's market. There are areas that we're not very excited about. You know, we do think there is somewhat of a bubble or a overvaluation in the concept of safety. You've seen some areas, not all, but of consumer staples or utilities or the former sector of telecommunications, because they had high dividend income and very, very low earnings volatility, get bid up almost indiscriminately, thanks primarily to ETFs. And some of those areas look expensive today, and those are the areas that are kind of driving that decline in earnings today at the same time. So that's an area that we're less excited about. I won't go into individual stock names, but certainly there are pockets in the equity market that look unattractive to us. So that's why I mentioned earlier that those two big areas that we are excited about, those are the areas seeing real organic growth, almost secular growth, meaning they don't necessarily require a robust economy to continue to do well. So you're right. We could even see what's called an earnings recession, something we also saw in 2015 and 2016, where earnings growth goes negative for a period, driven primarily by a couple of sectors. So we do feel like it is an important time to be focusing your equity allocation towards those areas that are still seeing organic growth and maybe dialing back some of the areas that have seen a lot of multiple expansion over the past decade and might be looking less healthy today, because even though they've had that multiple expansion, there really hasn't been any organic sales growth or earnings growth. So that's one piece of it.
No, that's
Sorry,
perfect.
Go ahead.
And Brian, we could not agree more with that. Again, it's not just about being diversified. It's about being diversified with a purpose and being a little bit more active and a little bit more selective going into 2020, I think makes all the sense in the world. And I almost want to use that as an opportunity to remind all the families on this call about the themes we've been discussing through 2009 before we close out, where we at Wealth Management Group have favored what I deem to be this barbell approach, where we've balanced growth equities with some lower volatility, higher quality names, albeit names that are still driving earnings growth without overvaluation. You know, we wanted to participate and still do in the fastest growing companies in America, but we got to balance those with companies that provide some better downside protection, due in particular to wide moats, consistent earnings growth. We have viewed fixed income or bonds really as a stock hedge. And that's the reason we've worked throughout the year to improve quality in fixed income, which allows us the opportunity to stay invested throughout this lengthy market cycle. And specifically, because of the cap and the changes to state and local taxes, we've been favoring municipal bonds, not just because of their tax-friendly nature, as the name implies, but there's also very strong technical momentum that's been created by the imbalance of supply and demand. And for everyone out there on the call who's retired, we were reminded yet again that with the latest Social Security cost of living adjustment only being a benign 1.6%, I think it's obvious to most, if not all Americans, that when we're retired, we can't rely on the government to grow our income. So that's why we need to continue to focus on dividend growth companies that provide us that built-in cost of living adjustment that we deserve as we're enjoying our retirement years. And finally, we just remind everybody and invite them that if we're already retired or about to retire, you know, now is a fantastic time to review your allocation. It's never too early to have a down deposit and building some reserves for some storm clouds just in case they approach, even though we remember the words that Brian mentioned today. Don't fight the Fed. The trend is your friend. New highs do tend to make new highs, right, Brian? And, of course, the market certainly seems to do a good job of consistently climbing a wall of worry. And those are all topics that we're going to continue to work with you as we close out 2019 and move into 2020. And again, I think it's that proactive approach with markets at all-time highs that make a great opportunity to make sure we reassess and are doing the right things to be positioned into 2020. Brian, I think your comments were spot on. I think they were well received. I think they were extremely timely, and there was no one better positioned to talk about where we are at in this market cycle, given the correct history you had in penning some of those publications all the way back in 2013. And from everybody at the Wealth Management Group team, it is a pleasure and an honor every day when we come to the office to help you, our clients, be excellent stewards of your capital. And from all of us, we wish you happy holidays, a Merry Christmas, and we hope throughout all the hustle and bustle that you just take time to be present. Be present in the moment with the loved ones, the family and friends that you surround yourself with, as you really recognize what each of us have in our own special way. It's our own definition of true wealth. It's everything that money can't buy and death can never take away. Thank you for your business. Lisa, you can conclude our call.
The opinions voiced on this call are for general information only and are not intended to provide or be construed as providing specific investment advice. or recommendations for any individual security. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Lord Abbott is not affiliated with LPL Financial or Wealth Management Group. Thank you.